This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 128. Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way for you to create your photography portfolio, a full website, blog, or online store to sell your photos. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and an incredible 24/7 customer support team. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And also by QuickBooks Self-Employed. If you run a photography company, even if it's a small company, you're just getting started, you just shoot a little bit on the side, QuickBooks Self-Employed is a great solution for you to keep your personal life and your business life separate, so you can track your miles and know exactly what you need to pay in your quarterly taxes. QuickBooks Self-Employed is essential for any small business, even if you're just shooting a couple gigs now and then. You can take the guesswork out of your federal quarterly taxes so you know exactly how much to pay and when to do it. It's going to keep track of everything for you. Try QuickBooks Self-Employed and receive 50% off at tryselfemployed.com/improve. That's tryselfemployed.com/improve. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm glad to have you joining us. My name is Jim Harmer, and I am your host today, joined by Darren Meller and, of course, Jeff Harmon. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Well, some pretty cool stuff happening this week. First, we got some great feedback on our episode last week, trying out a little bit of a different format to keep the discussion moving along. And so we're going to jump right in with that same one today. Jeff, I saw you had the question of the week about auto ISO.
Yep. So this came in from someone who had made the comment on the website, Jean-Marie, I'm not sure how you say the name. Sorry.
But, depends how French he's feeling.
Yeah. but they wanted to talk about something from last episode, and that's when we were talking about auto ISO and our whole argument then about manual versus auto modes, or at least semi-auto modes. And I'd kind of made the comment, Nick, I think, was talking about auto ISO, using that with manual to kind of help make it so the camera still does adjust a little bit to the light and changing light using an auto ISO feature. And I had kind of come in and said, well, that's great for people who have the really nice fancy cameras, but what about those that have maybe the less expensive DSLRs? And I don't think I was very clear, so I'm glad we get the chance to be able to talk about it again. What I was meaning was there's not a lot of the less expensive cameras don't have the feature to put a limit or a ceiling on how high that auto ISO can take it. So you have a camera that can go up to, let's say, 6400 ISO, but their pictures taken at that ISO are really pretty much unusable. Then if you have it on auto ISO and in manual mode, it could potentially take it all the way to that, and then you end up with a bunch of shots that don't work because that ISO is just too high. And so that's the feature that's missing. It's so crazy to me why they don't put that in. It like should cost nothing for that to be included in these less expensive cameras. It's software on the camera that should be there, but nonetheless, that's a feature that's not there on a lot of the less expensive DSLRs.
Yeah, it is surprising to me as well how long it's taken for that feature to come into the cameras, because you're right, it seems pretty basic to put that in a camera. In fact, I'd love to see a range priority mode that you can select a range for the aperture, a range for the shutter, and a range for the ISO, and just shoot like wild. Like, that would be so awesome in so many situations where, I do want to use the exposure meter on the camera, but I want to make sure it's going to do what I need it to do. And so if I could just set a range, that would be beautiful, especially in situations like, hey, here's a situation where I would use it. Let's say I'm shooting outdoors and I'm taking portraits outdoors. Well, I can shoot in manual mode, but then as soon as we step into the shade, the exposure changed and I got to fiddle with the camera again. I could shoot in aperture priority mode and say I just want a wide open aperture to blur out the background, but it's a little bit bright outside. And if I'm shooting at f2.8 in the middle of the day, my shutter speed is going to be sky high. And if you have a camera that only goes to 1/4,000th shutter speed, it very well could tap out. And every picture is going to be overexposed because you've selected f2.8 and it's the middle of the day. And the camera, you know, only has shutter and ISO left to pick. And if those are both as low as they can go to cut out the light, then it's just going to be overexposed. So I just want to set a range, you know? I just want to say f2.8, if we can be there, if we've got to go to f4, then let's go to f4, you know? I just want to set a range for so many different shoots that I would love to see that in the camera.
Yeah, I could see that being a huge feature. I mean, the ceiling on the ISO, that's also one thing as well, but the range, it would help so many of the students that have come across on photoclasses.com have their ability to still keep what they want in bokeh to a degree, but then also not have the other settings be kind of wonky. So yeah, that would be really cool. You should design a camera that has that in it, Jim.
I would love it. Well, do you use auto ISO, Darren?
I do not. I just refrain from using it because I found that there's something weird, and this is just maybe my observation, but I think there's two ISO levels that Canon cameras, both on the 70D and the 60D, they don't do well, and that's ISO 400 and particularly sometimes 800 on the crop sensor 70D. But there's other ISOs in the neighborhood of that area of level to where it performs perfectly fine, and that just, it's not making a lot of sense to me. It's like the sensor just gets to a point to where it's irritated. It just gets a little bit, has a little attitude or something like that.
Yeah. And are you using it at all, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I use auto ISO. I'll put it into, it depends. I go between either shutter priority or aperture priority a lot. And then I'll usually put auto ISO too. And because it's got the shutter or aperture that it can play with, it usually leaves the ISO in a reasonable range. So I'm happy with it. But boy, if it was in manual and I wasn't checking real carefully, I'd be worried about it getting over, especially since I use a crop sensor where the noise can really be a problem in the upper range of the ISO. I don't want shots in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't kind of gotten to the practice of using auto ISO because I was just so used to shooting the other way before it came in. But I keep trying to remind myself because it's a really useful mode. And a lot of situations, it's really just the best way to do it, I think.
Yeah, and I've seen the D750. I've a former peer of mine in the industry brought it in, and he was shot it at ridiculous ISOs. And I think that camera is probably one of the better full frame cameras for handling ISO, at least in my observation. Yeah, I mean, granted, I was looking at it on the back of his LCD screen and not a computer monitor, which should be more proper, but I think it handled it quite well.
Oh, very cool. Well, we want to talk in our main segment today about shooting panoramas and some of the tips that we have learned as we've been shooting panoramas. Panoramas is one of those things that I have to always remind myself of, kind of like auto ISO, I guess, that if I'm not like consciously, if I don't consciously have in my mind, I'm going to try to pull out a panorama today or this shoot or this week or whenever, it doesn't always leap to the mind. Sometimes it does, you know, you're at a scene that's just like, of course this has to be a panorama. And often I see that like when I'm at a big overlook over the city or something. Often those have got to be panoramas because what's cool is how much you can see. And so if you're not shooting panorama, it just doesn't make as much sense. Sometimes it screams at you, but a lot of times you really have to just kind of remind yourself to pull that trick out and try a panorama sometimes. The number one mistake I see with panoramas though, and I'm going to put like 95% of all panoramas in this category, is panoramas that are just wide for the sake of being wide. I guess one thing that I kind of use to judge a panorama is is there any part of this scene that could be a standalone image, you know, a non-panorama standalone image. And I don't think that's a perfect bar. I think there are certainly exceptions to that, but I think it's reasonable to think that way. Because if you don't think that way, you're going to wind up with just really wide shots that really have, you know, they don't have any foreground element. It's just There's no shape to the composition. It's just kind of stuff spread out across the scene. And so shooting wide for the sake of shooting wide, I think, is the biggest mistake in shooting panoramas.
Yeah, my tip is to also maybe try to pull out your phone first. I mean, I'm probably the least experienced out of the three of you for shooting panoramas, but I've pulled out my phone, and that would probably persuade me to actually pull out the camera if I saw the end result and actually liked the composition. Because I remember us discussing composition with panoramas, and people just kind of get lazy with their compositions. So that'd be my tip, is to make sure that you're at least looking at the whole scene and seeing whether or not this whole wide shot actually tells a story of what you're trying to point out with your photo.
You said the three of us. Does that mean like the ghost of Erica Kay? Is that the third person you're referring to?
Yeah, the ghost of Erica Kay, since we haven't heard from her in so long.
It has been a little bit since we've heard Erica. It's wedding season. She's busy.
Yep.
So my tip is has to do with how to figure out how to overlap the shots. If you're shooting on a smartphone, it's like one continuous motion. It's pretty cool the way that works. But obviously, you've got to take distinct, separate shots as you're doing a panorama to glue them all together. And you need enough overlap then between the shots that you can actually have the software be successful at stitching them together and make it look decent, too. If the further apart they are, you get in danger of having the software not being able to stitch it together. But it also has more of a warped perspective. If they're not overlapping a lot, then it can't do as good a job of fixing kind of a warped perspective as you're taking a whole bunch of shots and stitching them together. So what I've come to really like is I get the camera in live view mode, and then I've turned on the grid, the composition help grid, where it's like split into thirds, and then I just use the thirds to determine where I'm taking the shot. I'll start sweeping from the left to the right, and then I can see on the live view where the third line is right now, and then I move the camera so that it only goes to that same feature in the landscape, ends up on the other third line. So if I'm going from left to right, it starts on the right-hand side third line, and then I'll move the camera to the right until it goes, that same landscape feature moves to the left third line. And that's produced really good results for me, that I can make sure I've got a really good amount of overlap in the shots as I'm going to go stitch them together later.
That's a good rule. I usually use the 40% rule, that a lot of people say they overlap about 20% of the picture. I don't think that's nearly enough, because usually when you're shooting a panorama, you're using a wide angle lens, because the reason you're going panoramic is because you want to include more of the scene. So unless you're creating some massive high megapixel image, most people aren't going to use a telephoto lens for a panorama. So we're often using a wide angle when we're doing panoramas, right? And the problem with wide angles is they distort a lot. And so if you are only overlapping 20% and you're on a wide angle lens, you don't stand a whole lot of chance to get it right. Because think about what's happening. You have around the edges of the frame are where all the distortion happens. And so it would be easy for the software to stitch together the photos if those pixels on the right side of the frame were just a perfect pixel by pixel match for what's on the left side of the next frame, right? Like, that'd be a piece of cake. But it's all distorted and stuff. And so you got to think about the algorithm that's happening there to undistort and match up what's supposed to go together, even though they're both distorted in different directions. That's pretty incredible. So you got it. I mean, give the software a break, man, and make it easy on the software by overlapping a lot. Another thing that I often do is I will make huge overlaps on the very edge pictures, on the very edges of the panorama. So if I'm starting on the left, I'll take them, maybe overlap 50%, and then go to 30, 30, 30 in the middle, and then more pictures out toward the edges. Because when you're, because if you have made any accidental movements up or down on the edges, left and right, that's where you're going to have to crop off a big piece of the picture. And so I tend to take more pictures on the sides than in the middle, so that hopefully I won't mess that up. And if I do, it'll only be a small piece until the next picture starts.
Yeah, and actually I've been reading something as well that came up as a good tip is to not focus on things that are really close to you, especially trees and bushes that are in the foreground, because if you're trying to stitch that together, a lot of software will have trouble with that. It'll start to make up bushes and trees in there, and sometimes it can make up a tree with two stumps that are coming together, and that might look cool, but in reality that really doesn't exist. So I would take a look at what you're actually putting into the foreground of the photo as well.
Very good point. Well, panoramas are really fun to shoot. I guess we can kind of use this as our reminder to spend a little bit more to at least think of panoramas. And sometimes I think it can be kind of cool to use them in very unexpected places, just to do something different. You know, when you're shooting wedding photos or something, it's like, or a senior picture, or whatever, you're doing a portrait shoot, how you kind of shoot for a while and it's like, well, I got it. You know, I don't have any other ideas for poses or anything. So the shoot kind of ends. Sometimes, like, think of a technique from a totally different discipline. Like, can you use a panorama of a wedding photo? Maybe it'd be cool. Have the whole wedding party lined up behind the couple and just have the couple in the middle up kind of close to the camera. You know, just think of something totally different you could do. And so panorama is a good technique to throw in kind of an unexpected place for a little bit something different. Well, we want to get to the round robin where we will each talk about a topic for 5 minutes. But I have a little I told you so for Mr. Nick Page. Was it last episode or was it two episodes that we had quite the debate about white balance? And many of you chimed in on the show notes, your differing opinions on it. Well, Nick Page was so certain that I was wrong about white balance that he went out and bought himself an Expo disc. And he was determined that he was going to like that thing. And on the Portrait Session podcast, which is in the Improved Photography Network, if you're not listening to Portrait Session as well as this one, you're missing out on a big piece of what we do. Nick talked about the Expo disc trying as much as possible to make it seem like it was positive. But listen to the actual words he says. His experience was terrible, and he's trying to make it sound like he liked it. So this is my little I told you so for Mr. Nick Page. I'm going to play a little segment of the Portrait Session podcast.
View because hopefully Jim Harmer's listening to this one, because Jim is going to love what Nick is reviewing this week.
Yeah, so after getting in the argument with Jim on Improved Photography, I went and bought an Expo disc. And so basically what they're designed to do is help you get your white balance. It's like a white balance tool where you put it up in front of your lens, you take a shot, and then you use that to set your custom white balance. And so I tried it out. I got it and I tried it out at my wedding that I had this weekend. And at first, they come with these warming gels. And essentially all they are is these little gels that you put inside of the Expo disc, and they actually create a blue cast. That way, when you create a custom white balance off of using those, it makes a warmer white balance. And so when I tried it out, I was shocked at how much warmer those make it. Like, it was giving me some pretty crazy white balance readings. So I ended up using it without the warming gels because it was just way over the top, too warm. I thought that it would be a lot slower. I thought that it would really slow me down, but I found it didn't really slow me down at all to create my custom white balances with it. Although I felt like it wasn't super consistent, and it wasn't exactly the white balances that I would have chose. They gave me some pretty interesting results, but I liked it. And I think that a lot of times, if you're dealing with like really strong color casts, I think this will be a good tool. I need to do a little bit more testing, but yeah, that's what I've been trying out. So I'm still up in the air about it, but I'll report back once I have more information about it.
At the end of the day, I'm still sold on shooting in Kelvin. I think that when you're around that,
all right, you get the idea.
Nick Page for president in 2016, because that sounded like a politician trying to sell himself.
The spin doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is good. I did this for you. Taxes really went down when I raised taxes. I heard words like not super consistent, way over warm. I don't know. I'm calling the white balance war a lost one. Just stick with auto white balance, people. I had to throw that in since Nick wasn't here. Well, we want to get on to the round robin segment, where we're each going to take 5 minutes. But before we do that, we want to take just a second and thank our sponsors or the supporters of the Improved Photography podcast. And the first one that we want to talk about is QuickBooks Self-Employed. When I started running a business, probably the most intimidating and the least enjoyable part of the business was doing the books. It is, for any entrepreneur, even if you're just starting a little photography business and you just shoot one or two gigs, you're just doing a tiny bit, eventually you're going to have to pay taxes, and you have to keep everything in order every time you do. I lost a ton of money the first several years of my business because I didn't have a good system in place for tracking my expenses, tracking especially my miles. You know, you drive to a photo shoot. Well, those are business miles. And so you should be writing it off. If you are, you could be earning 56 cents a mile every mile you drive under a lot of conditions. You know, check your personal tax advisor. But there are just so many deductions and things that you should be getting credit for. And I just didn't get to it because I was busy being a photographer. I was busy trying to do my business, and I never quite got to the books to get them in nice order. Well, QuickBooks Self-Employed is exactly what can help you to do that. Helps you to separate your business and personal expenses, keep everything in order, track your expenses, know exactly what you need to pay in your quarterly taxes, because when you're self-employed, you're going to need to pay those quarterly taxes. QuickBooks provides you with the tools you need to maximize your deductions like home office and mileage. Find out what QuickBooks Self-Employed can do for you and receive 50% off at tryselfemployed.com/improve. That's tryselfemployed.com/improve. And this episode is also brought to you by Squarespace. We've talked about Squarespace a lot of times on the podcast, and it's because we love it. I'm using Squarespace. Darren, I know you're using Squarespace. How's your website doing for you?
It's doing really well. There's lots of hits on it. I spelled portfolio wrong in the beginning stages, and it was really easy to fix. Someone sent me an email and said, hey, portfolio has a T in it. I'm not trying to be that guy, but it only took 2 seconds to update.
You had your portfolio.
Yes, I did.
Well, and something that Nick Page is doing that we really need to get him on to tell us how it's going is he's using the e-commerce section of Squarespace to sell his photography work right on the website. That is really cool. I've been running websites for several years now full time, and I know how much work it can be to get a shopping cart implemented, make sure everything's secure, make sure you get all the orders, that everything's taken care of, and Squarespace can do all of that for you. It's an easy way to set up your photography portfolio, get your information up there, look completely professional on whatever device that somebody's on, and it starts at just $8 a month to take care of your photography website, and you get a free domain with that when you sign up for a year. Start your free trial at today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use offer code IMPROVE and you'll get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. All right, now we're going to jump into the round robin segment. And the first one, I'll take the first one. I know all of us are very interested in this one. We had Photoshop 2015 announced, and we had an update on the website within 60 seconds of the announcement to talk about all of the new features. So you may have read the article that I wrote at improvephotography.com that outlines quite a few things. But as we've had a few days to dig into the software, we have found some interesting things and we want to report on. Jeff and Darren, tell me this first. What was the biggest thing, the biggest single change that we saw in Photoshop 2015 or the update to Lightroom?
The most recent one?
Yeah.
Okay. Probably the dehaze feature.
I would agree. Darren, any thought on that?
I've seen a photographer local to me who's up and coming, and he posted a shot that just looked completely horrid of the Milky Way, used the dehaze feature. He said it worked in the picture. It worked great in that. He says it's worked great for nightclub photography type shots with fog machines going. Yeah, but this, I mean, the way that astrophotography shot turned out, I didn't even think it was the same photo. That was really exciting. I think Jeff stole my thunder on that one, but I could comment on it with a lot of excitement after seeing that photo. I'll have to see if I can get his permission to link to that photo, just the comparison of what it looked like before and after with that dehaze function.
That really is pretty cool. I had never really even thought about using the dehaze for night photography. You got the wheels turning now. I'm going to have to test that out on a few photos. So the dehaze feature, I don't know why they call it dehaze. It's just haze. Mm-hmm. Because you can slide the slider to the left and you get rid of haze, or slide it to the right and you add haze to the picture. And by haze, we mean kind of the fog look. In the press conference, they showed a few photos that, I mean, really, really showed it off well. One, they showed a photo with a train that was, I mean, you could tell it was just a tiny bit foggy in the background. And then they added haze to it, and it just looked so moody. It just looked really, really cool. Just gave the photo a lot of personality. As soon as I saw that slide on the presentation, I thought, oh, man, prepare yourselves for the onslaught of moody fog photos that we are about to see. And then also it can remove the haze, and it does it quite well. I mean, it's not perfect because, I mean, the detail's not there. It's not there. If the haze is just covering the detail, it's not. It can't just draw in the detail. But it really did a remarkable job of removing that haze. I think we might finally see the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge now with this dehaze feature. That was the most exciting to me. It is available in Lightroom and Photoshop, but only Lightroom CC. Lightroom 6, nope. Lightroom CC is the one that is going to be getting this. So that was a nice thing to see that we have some new features coming in. There wasn't a whole lot else about that came out in this update. In Photoshop, we see a couple quite minor improvements, but welcome. One, for example, is that the Content Aware Move tool is a little bit better. It's using Content Aware Fill in the previous location from when you moved it. And so it really did a nice job, which I really like that. And then once you move something using Content Aware Move, there is a little new little tick box at the top now that you can scale the item that you moved, and it'll Content Aware Fill around if you scaled down. So interesting. Not a lot coming out of this release, but it's something, and it's welcome. I was interested to see in the press conference what they focus on most, because it kind of gives us a little direction of what may happen in the future. And they talked a lot about Creative Sync, which really is just a marketing term. They kind of talked it up a lot. And then somebody asked, I can't remember who asked it. It might have been Nicole Young. I can't remember. Somebody asked in the press conference, said, so is this just a marketing term? Because I thought we already had that. And they're like, yeah, it is. So basically all it does is it syncs changes between Photoshop and Lightroom, the desktop versions, and the apps on your phone and tablet. But they really are pushing that a lot. I asked if we will hopefully see a way to sync our catalogs and in Lightroom between devices, and the answer that I heard word for word was something like, we hope to release that feature in the future, maybe even later this year, I think is the exact word they used. But I thought, maybe later this year, because man, do I want that. That is like the feature that's killing me in Lightroom. I just want to be able to go from my desktop to laptop seamlessly and have everything there, all my photos, everything I need. That would just be absolutely beautiful. And it looks like that's a direction that Adobe's heading. You know, did he maybe speak out of turn and we won't see it this year? Yeah, maybe so. I was excited that there was that hope in it, at least in what he said. They also talked a lot about Adobe Stock, which Adobe purchased Fotolia last year. And it's basically just they have a stock service now for Adobe. They're really pushing it a lot, but I think this won't really impact a lot of photographers other than you can now contribute directly to Adobe Stock. How well will it sell? I have no idea if it's going to take off or not, but I hope it does for their sake. All right, Jeff, what's your 5 minutes?
All right, so I'm going to add some nerdiness to the Adobe Cloud update.
Great.
The first thing was a surprise for me, and I didn't notice until this morning. I use an SSD for my system drive on my computer, make things go faster. And it's only a 250 gig drive, which for my system drive should be plenty. All the software you'd install and whatever is just there, and all the documents and photos and everything else, I've got on other drives. So I'm routinely at less than half the disk is being used. And when I looked this morning, I was doing some other things, and my Windows was showing me it was red and almost completely full. I had 23 megabytes left. I was like, what happened? And so it took me some time to figure out what happened here. And what seems to have gone on was Adobe was trying to be helpful and realized that I was likely to want to install the updated versions of Creative Cloud. And it pre-downloaded them all. And then so that when I finally launched the Adobe Creative Cloud Updater and I said, yes, I want to go update these apps, it just started immediately installing. There was no download time, that's kind of nice. But it also meant there was 100 gigs of installs that had been pre-downloaded. And because of how my Windows was set up, the temporary location that Windows was pointing to was still on that system drive. So I had 100 gig of stuff added to my system drive. Thankfully, I had the room for it, but that was a real shocker to me as I did it. So I didn't know what it was at first. I'm going to tell you a tool in a little bit for my Dude Out of the Week that I used to find what was suddenly taking up all my drive space. And then they were named ACC, and then they had a date.log. So they even looked like they were log files. Like, what is this? And I did a search, and there's a link that I found from Adobe's forums that talked about, oh, yeah, those are just our temp files. You can delete them. They're fine. You can just get rid of them, especially if they're more than 7 days old. Just delete them. And so, okay. So I did the installs, and then I even rebooted to see if maybe it cleaned up after itself, and it didn't. They were all still there. So I manually deleted them, and that's why I wanted to bring it up today was, yeah, you might want to check and see if you've got a whole bunch of temporary files built up from Creative Cloud updating. Now, I have the full Creative Cloud, so it's not just Lightroom and Photoshop. It will be a lot less if it's just those two.
And how many of the programs do you have actually installed?
I think it's 8 of them overall. That's from the suite. Yeah, it's quite a few. So you know, it won't be that dramatic probably for most people listening. But it's still an important thing to be aware of and know that you probably got a whole bunch of disk space that you could go clean up from Adobe doing some kind of a smart update there. The other thing that happened for me, and Jim said it didn't happen for him on the Mac, was it automatically deleted all the previous versions of all the software. So I now only have one install of every program, which is probably okay. Jim said, you said you wanted it, right?
Yeah, to me that's beautiful. I can see why you wouldn't want it, especially if there are bugs in it.
Yeah.
But I don't like having to go and delete the old one. That's the whole purpose of Creative Cloud. It's just like an app on your phone, just updates itself, just goes. That's how I would love it to be if they're giving us stable releases.
Now, I was actually warned of that when I went to install. So when I finally, even though it had pre-downloaded all the installs, when I went through Creative Cloud app to say I wanted to actually update to the latest version, as I clicked on the update for Photoshop in particular, and there were two others. I can't remember which ones. Not Lightroom. Well, no, maybe Lightroom was because I don't have... No, I still have 5.7.1 of Lightroom as well. So yeah, Lightroom did not delete the previous version. But Photoshop, when I clicked the button, it said, when you do this, you're going to lose the old version. Are you okay with that? And I was fine in this case to do that. But so I got that in Windows. Did you not see that message at all when you did this on Mac?
No, I didn't see that.
Now, the only weird thing I saw was Audition 2015 or 2014 disappeared from my dock, and it was just a question mark, and then I had to just go into its Launchpad feature and drag the 2015 to my dock.
Okay, so that means it did get rid of the old version for you then when you installed that. Yeah. So, I don't know. It's a little bit different experience between the two platforms. The reason that you should know about it is you got to decide if you care about having the old one or not, but also... If you had any third-party plugins, and Adobe made this clear in some of their form posts and information related to what's changed, you're going to have to manually move those from where they were located in like the 2014 version or in the standalone version into the new one. So not necessarily, they said they're going to try to bring across presets and things like that in Lightroom, but if there's actual third-party plugins that you're using in Photoshop or Lightroom, you're going to have to manually bring those across.
Okay, so presets should come, but plugins, no.
Should, yeah.
Well, and it's important because of exactly what you're saying. If you have a smaller hard drive, which you have 250 gigs, I've got to think that's very, very common, maybe the most common size on a lot of computers, because so many people are using laptops, that really is a problem. I can see why Adobe is doing that, is kind of pre-downloading the software. One, it makes it quicker when you're ready to install, and two, think about how much bandwidth they've got to send out on install day of a new version. I mean, holy cow. Can you imagine the load on their servers? How many millions of creatives are using Photoshop, and they've got to send this very large program down to that many computers? They're going to have to space out that download so it doesn't happen all at the same time, and that's a way for them to do it. They're doing the same thing with Windows. It's coming in pieces when the network's quiet, a little by little over time. Then when you're ready to go, you just click go and it switches.
Yeah, I'd expect that's going to happen in a lot of big update things. That's just like a very practical way to approach it. So that's good, although that means they've got to really nail it on not having big problems.
Yeah, that Apple used to do all at once, and so you could just guarantee you were not getting the download for the first 2 days that a new version was released, because the servers were just hammered.
Okay, another couple of quick things to mention. Photoshop, it's kind of a minor thing, but there used to be a Save for Web feature. It's been deprecated. It's moved to legacy, I think is how they put it.
Yeah, why is it moved to legacy? I use that like 15 times every single day. When I saw legacy, I was like, no, don't legacy it. And why did you add one more click? I use that every day.
Right. But and the good thing is there is a positive out of it. And that's that it produces, it looked like, I've done some testing on it today. It looks like the end results are very, very close. I can't tell the difference, but the files are 40% smaller. The JPEGs that it produces out of the new export feature that's replacing the Save for Web is producing files that are 40% smaller for JPEGs. So that's cool.
And, you know, there's a lot of marketing speak from all these companies, but that one I can verify, because I saved some out today that I was really surprised at the file sizes I got. Yeah. The reason that this is useful is if you're just saving a photo and you're putting it up to Squarespace, forget all this. You don't need to do any of this. Just save out a regular high-res JPEG, and Squarespace is going to take care of everything for you. If you're putting it on Facebook, excuse me, same deal. Instagram, same deal. They're going to take care of the file size for you. But if you're putting it on your own website, like on improvephotography.com, nobody's resizing it for you. You have to resize it correctly. Otherwise, somebody goes to the page, and it's going to take forever for that page to download because the picture's too big. So that's where people are using it. So if you have a website, or you're going to need this, and it's something we'll use all the time. So that's a really nice feature to see the reduced file size.
I found it helpful for sending it to clients too, so they can help cull through some of the photos. You know, I'll take out the obvious no's, but they want to go through that experience as fast as possible, and having a massive image so that they're waiting on a loading screen every time they move to the next image doesn't work well. So making them as small as possible is really, really nice.
Are the JPEGs also smaller that come out of Lightroom? Did you see anything on that?
I didn't test that. So that would be an interesting thing to find out, because that is where I do this from. So
because Lightroom files are always, substantially bigger than Photoshop files. Yeah. You know, you take the exact same image, open one in Photoshop and save out a JPEG at 60 quality, then save out a JPEG at 60 quality in Lightroom. The Photoshop one is a lot smaller than the Lightroom when we're talking about that quality slider.
It's a good question. I would hope that because it's there in Photoshop, it's probably something they've added in Lightroom too, but they didn't mention it specifically, so I need to go test it. Just one more then. Reduced energy. So this is one actually I didn't even know about. Jim put it in here.
I saw it in the release notes, and I was like, oh, this is nerdy. Jeff's going to like
it.
This
is. It's cool. So when it's just sitting idle, and it should matter on battery life too. It should help on battery life, which is probably what the main target is. If your laptop is running and you're running Photoshop and it's just sitting there, maybe you're at a with a client and you're doing other things not in Photoshop, or whatever reason you're not actively using Photoshop, they've made a bunch of changes where they say that you could save up to 80% of the energy usage while Photoshop is running, as long as it's not actively being used. So
that is
cool.
Pretty cool. And that is huge, because when we got this new version of Lightroom and Photoshop, I mean, they just kill battery life. My Mac Air lasts 13 hours of battery. When I am using Lightroom, the battery just, it's like I can see the battery meter going down. Because I mean, it really is just sucking power like crazy with this latest release. I mean, I didn't like time it or anything, but it was a substantial reduction in the battery life now that it's using the GPU and such. So I'm glad to see that they're aware of this and they're working on that.
All right. Well, took my 10 minutes.
Well, that's because I wouldn't let you talk. Darren, how about you?
Mine is about entering a photo contest to challenge yourself to be better. I've always heard with sports and cycling and even photography, surround yourself with people who are more proficient in it. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've grown as a photographer by shooting and working with Jim, and I've grown as a photographer by working with people who are really great, who have traveled with us on the workshops, and I think there's a lot of sense to this. So recently we launched a contest at Pixoto, and it's judged by the one and only Jim Harmer, and the contest is actually called Destination Landscape, and we opened this up for everyone who's on Pixoto, and Jim's a big Pixoto nerd, so I figured, well, Jim's a nature photographer, he's really proficient with his landscape shots, and I think with his portfolio review service that we offer as well, he could do us justice as far as judging the best photo for this. So the submission deadline is July 12th, 2015, and Jim has a week from there to look at the photos and pick the best one out of it. There's top three prizes. One's a pro membership account. The other two are some credits for your Pixoto account. And then from there, we'll pick the absolute best landscape photo. And this is going to not just be your run-of-the-mill photo there. It's going to be a photo that's not taken in your backyard. And when I launched this contest, I talked to Jeff, and Jeff was actually a little bit sad because he has a really beautiful backyard, and I've seen some of his photos. So I think you should still submit that one, Jeff.
And you said we at Pixoto. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. I joined Pixoto on Monday. It was my first day. I started working for Jason Kiefer with Pixoto. He's a great guy out of Boulder, Colorado, and I'm doing marketing and community relations. I'm actually learning some of the nerdy stuff that Jeff has learned for 20 years, which is like SQL and HTML. And Jeff and I were talking about the Matrix movie, about how I wish that he could just transfer that over to me via his brain to mine, but there would probably be some cost associated with that because it took him about 20 years to learn something he's taken for granted.
Pay up. Well, congratulations. We have always loved Pixoto. Like, it's our little crush on improved photography is Pixoto. And so I'm glad to see that we have a representative in the door working at Pixoto now. Congratulations on that.
I'd love for you to find out the mystery, Darren, if the square ratios are some magical thing or not. I've resubmitted lots of photos now as square, and they've all outdone the normal like wider aspect ratios that I've submitted. So there's something magic there.
I think the reason that we see that, since I'd noticed that and mentioned it on the podcast, I think all of us have tried it, and I've seen huge improvements on my scores too by putting in squares, and I know Nick did as well. I think the reason is it cuts off the sides, and so the action, the center of the photo, is bigger. And you only get it's a pretty small photo that they give you to pick left or right, you know, which one you prefer. And so since it's small and you're making the action bigger, it kind of really helps the whole photo. I think if we were to see the photos, you know, full screen big, it probably wouldn't make an improvement at all. In fact, it may hurt. But I think because it's so small, the square seems to really work.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually mentioned that in my interview before landing the job, so I brought it to Jason's attention. So we're going to look at that and see if there's anything we could possibly do to make that a little bit better of a feature. But in the same token, maybe, you know, it's a good thing to have the action be in the center of the photo. Maybe it'll help with composition. But from there, back to the contest, the Jim is going to be looking for things to where you're paying attention to details such as composition, palatable editing, and trying to just get the most beautiful images out there. When I started for this contest, I wanted it to just kind of have that travel bug inside of you, just be invigorated and just bubbling around inside of you, because I want you to post a photo that just says, hey, this is going to make anyone who looks at it want to go there and take this shot. So that's really what I think we should do, is enter a photo contest. If it's a Pixoto photo contest, that's great. If it's your county fair, I know it's summertime here in the United States right now, and there's lots of county fairs coming up in June, July, and August. Enter a county fair, your state fair, and see if you can win a contest, because not only is it going to be gratifying, but it can also be humbling to maybe get your work grounded so you can figure out whether or not you need to improve and what direction you need to go. And also, you'll be having your photos, just like in this contest, next to other people's photos who may be better than you, and it'll help you get some different perspective, challenge yourself, and also get a new vision and look at things.
Well, very cool. That'll be a great contest. Well, in every episode, we want to share a doodad of the week. And mine is a little bit of a different one, but really, really valuable. I bet all of you who listen to this will at some point take advantage of this doodad. And is the Uchida DecoColor marker. I ordered a huge print. I think it was 40 by 62 inches. I don't know what that is in meters. Sorry, folks. But a really, really big print, like almost as tall as I am wide. a really big print anyway, and so I wanted to sign it. My brother is a dentist in St. George, Utah, and so I made a bunch of canvas gallery wraps, and then I'm going to display them in his office and then, you know, decorates his office, and then they're also for sale there. Well, I wanted to print it, or I wanted to sign the prints, and it was a $200 print, a canvas gallery wrap, so I didn't want to mess it up. And so I decided, you know what? I want to know what the marker is for this. And so I searched and searched to see other fine art photographers, what people are using as their favorite marker, and nobody really knew. Everybody said something different. So I went out and I bought 18 markers from several different stores. My wife came home and she said, "What are you doing? I thought you said you had work to do." And I said, "I am working." And so I tested 18 different markers. I, you know, saw what it looked like. I tried smudging the pen to see if the ink would stay fast. Saw which one had, you know, the brightest color of silver to stand off a dark background. I did a torture test where I dunked it in water and then put it in the oven and all kinds of different things. And it, you know, it may seem really, really overkill, but I just wanted to know which one was best. And there was actually a huge, dramatic difference in the markers. Some of them, there's no way I would put on a print that I would send to a client because they were smudging. There's no way they would last very long because after that torture test, one of them was entirely erased. You couldn't even see the marker anymore with the Bic marker. It had just completely erased. Some of the Sharpies did as well. And others, I mean, there was nothing I could do to it to make it smudge or erase from it. So the one that I liked is the Uchida DecoColor. We'll link to it in the show notes. Just go to improvephotography.com/128 and we'll have a link, or just go to the homepage and you'll see that article that I wrote there and see the different ones. Just go ahead and order one on Amazon now. It's like $6. And then whenever you have a print, you'll be able to do it. The thing that I loved about this one is it worked on canvases. It worked on paper. It even worked on glossy prints, which is amazing because not many will do that without smudging. So I got a glass print from Fracture that was a previous sponsor of the podcast. And even on glass, I thought, okay, I don't know how this is going to work. It will not smudge. I mean, it was just totally, totally cool. So the Uchida DecoColor in silver ultra fine tip is my doodad of the week. Jeff?
All right. So I mentioned earlier that I used a utility to help me find the massive files that were suddenly on my SSD. The utility is one that's been around for ages. It's called WinDirStat, like Windows Directory Stat. And when you run it, you can point it to a drive on your machine, and it goes out and it detects it. It pulls in all of the file sizes on your computer, and it gives you a really handy little tree that shows like where the bulk of this file sizes are in the directories or in the different folders. And you can drill down, and that's how I was able to find what they were or where they were. It didn't, and then I had to go search for the file names. But Really, really helpful utility to be able to track down where is all your disk space going. I also found some old caches from like previous installs of Lightroom where I tested things and I hadn't yet moved the caching directory to a different disk and so on. So I freed up a ton of space on my SSD today by having this tool help me find where is there stuff that I don't need anymore that were temp files or whatever it's been built up. And if you go to winderstat.info, that's where you can download it for utility. They actually made a suggestion because they don't make a Windows or a Mac version, but they mentioned two other utilities. One's called Disk Inventory X and another one, Grand Perspective. Have you guys used either of those?
No, but no, I'm downloading it.
Okay, so they recommended as a very similar utility as Winderstat is for Windows. So you might check that out for you Mac users to go either of those utilities. I haven't used them, so I can't vouch for them, but really helpful tool to make sure you're on top of your disk space.
Very cool. Good to know. Darren?
Yes, mine's accidental damage coverage for your camera gear, and I know a lot of people are going to shudder when I say this because it's an extra fee that you pay at the time of purchase. Yeah, there's a pun. But yeah, I actually was able to sell my Sony A6000, and one of the selling points that I put on there was that it has a transferable accidental damage insurance. So if you dump it in water, if you leave it on the top of your car and drive off and it rolls off the back and has a horrible death, as long as you bring back pieces to the place or send it in if you live far away from where the store is when you sell it, they will actually replace it if it's not repairable and no questions asked, no deductible, and it actually makes the camera warranty longer. It's kind of like an extended warranty on your car, but you can bring back pieces of it and shards as long as that you don't break it right in front of them where it's not accidental, then they replace it. So that actually helped me recover almost the full price of what I paid for that camera brand new. So I'm no longer shooting Sony. I'm strictly a Canon guy now.
Okay, so tell me this. Every time it comes up to the question of, you know, do you want the extended warranty after you've already just destroyed your pocketbook by buying something expensive, I almost always say no, because they would not offer the extended warranty if they weren't going to win statistically, right? True. Like, they know, because they have tens of thousands of people who bought. There's no way they're doing this just for kicks or just for, you know, to be nice. They're doing this to make money. And so they run the statistics and they know about what percentage of are going to break. And you know, it's a booming business. You know, companies like Best Buy are like living off the money from this kind of thing. And so every time I say no, because I know statistically I'm going to lose money. So what makes you sometimes say yes? Or is it just, what would make you say yes? Because I always say no. I know I'm statistically going to lose.
Past experience, because Murphy follows me around like a bad habit. I left a computer out in the rain once, a MacBook Pro, a 17-inch, and they replaced that. And the year before that, I was really into Halloween, and I set up my MacBook Pro in a second-story window, a bay window, and I took the screen off so I could, you know, put the computer there and play Halloween music for the trick-or-treaters and whatnot, and it slid down the roof, hit concrete, and there's pictures on Facebook of how well it fared, but it was just completely trashed, and they replaced both of those computers, no questions asked, and luckily I haven't broken this new one. But the only downfall is that once it's broken, you have to repurchase that warranty again on the new item that's replaced. So that is the downside to it. So statistically, they do win because they may pay out, you know, $200 for a MacBook Pro, but you still have to give them $600 to reinsure the new one.
Yeah, I pre-ordered the Sony A7R II
this morning.
I did it. As soon as pre-orders were open, I got my order on Amazon in right away. And it wanted $399 for the extended warranty. And I just thought, no, I'm not doing it. Statistically, I'm going to lose. I know that I'm terrible on cameras, though. And so I almost thought, you know, I'm bad enough on cameras. There are enough cameras in the camera graveyard that maybe I am the exception to this statistic, because it's absurd. Like, I have to do a better job of taking care of it. But I don't know. I still didn't do it because the nerd in me just gets angry with myself that I would even consider it, knowing that I'm going to statistically lose. Jeff, do you buy them?
I never do, but I'm doing it out of a hobbyist budget here. And there's not, like, if if the camera got ruined, it's not my livelihood. It's not my business. It's not, you know, it's just my hobby that suffers for a while. So I could do without it. I could see where this is your livelihood and so on. There could be a reason to do it. I mean, especially you, Jim, you go through them so fast that I could see that could be an advantage.
Yeah. And a lot of people insure their gear as well. And sure. I'm the same with insurance. I don't buy insurance for my gear. I really think the only time you should insure your gear, I mean, you should get insurance for other things, but the only time you should insure your gear is if the camera goes out or whatever piece of gear it is, you aren't going to be able to replace it. I mean, if you're running a bare bones business, you're just barely making it, starting out as a portrait photographer, and if your camera crapped out today, you'd be like, I got to close the doors, I'm done. Then you should have insurance. But again, you know, statistically, you're going to lose. And so I don't get it. Because if my camera died, it would stink, but I could go buy another one, you know? And so that's kind of my thought on it.
Well, yes, but the other reason I don't is because I have done it a couple of times when I was younger. Like the very first time, I can't remember, I was maybe 15, and I'd worked summer jobs to make enough money to finally buy a Sony CD player for, woo! It was like $400. Walkman, baby. Yeah, it was long. And they said, do you want the extended warranty? We'll fix it if the laser gets out of position, which was a real bad problem with CD players, that you were portable. So I was like, okay. And I never used it. It didn't matter. I spent, I don't know, another $100 on an extended warranty. And a couple other times I've been, you know, burned by it too, where I never have used it. If I've ever bought it, I've never used it. So yeah, I've decided not to.
And a lot of them are so scammy, especially the one on, well, I don't know if it's all the same one on Amazon, but I've heard a lot of very negative reviews about people who bought the extended warranty through Amazon and they just didn't replace it. And so do be cautious about the company that's doing it, because obviously they can check a lot of fine print in there. And frankly, I mean, what? It's over a few $100 most of the time. What are you going to do if they deny your claim? Complain about, I mean, there's nothing you can do, really, realistically. And so do be careful that it's a really good one. I did, however, buy an extended warranty this week because I bought a new iPhone for my wife. My previous iPhone died a terrible milky death. It fell in the milk. Anyway, and I thought, wife killed last three iPhones. Should I get extended warranty? Yes. She's worse on iPhones than I am on cameras. So sometimes it's good. I know Apple's extended warranty is just, I mean, nobody beats it. And so... Yeah. I think there are some times, but only if you really feel like you are the exception. If you're, you know, average haphazardness, save money and don't do it is my thought. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode of the Improved Photography Podcast. We really appreciate your download of the show. Come check us out at improvephotography.com. Jeff Harmon and I are always putting up new content on the website and other writers that we are glad to have up there. So come check it out at improvephotography.com. Also, you may want to check out improvephotography.com/workshops because we have some new things up there, and improvephotography.com/China. We are going to China in 2016, and it's going to be the best workshop to ever be done ever. It's just going to be absolutely awesome. Go check it out. Do not let 2016 pass you by without taking advantage of this. It's going to be absolutely awesome. That's at improvephotography.com/China. At least check it out and see if there's any way you could sell a kidney and get there, because it's going to be great. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll see you next week.